Okay, I would like to introduce today's presenter. Rob McGovern is a technical account manager for Infusion Development. And again, the title of today's MSDN webcast is Introduction to ASP.NET for JSP Developers, Part 2 of a 4-part series, Building Applications. Rob, you now have the floor.
Hi, I'm Rob McGovern from Infusion Development. If you were on the first part of the series earlier this morning, we did a quick overview of ASP.NET, how it relates to Java development. What are the similarities? What are some of the major differences? And how they kind of work together, how you should think about moving to ASP.NET from a Java point of view. This session, we'll get into a little more detail about actually building an application. So you're going to see more code in the demos. You're going to see more use of Visual Studio. And we'll go through it. The third session tomorrow is about the actual architecture of ASP.NET. So once you get behind the scenes of the drag and drop and configure with properties and all the good stuff I'm going to show you today, how's all that actually working and what kind of control do you have over it? How can you change it? And that's the subject of tomorrow's talk. Wednesday's talk is really about the whole process of migrating an application from Java to ASP.NET. There's a couple of choices and a couple of approaches that we'll go into during that session. But really that whole course or the whole session on Wednesday focuses on moving from Java to ASP.NET. So in today's session, what we're going to cover are three main things. First, how do you build an application using ASP.NET in Visual Studio 2005? What kind of functions and controls can you leverage? What built-in services are available? How do you configure it? How do you work with it? What's all the good stuff? So session prerequisites. Attending the first session isn't absolutely necessary. This session should stand alone. But it'd be useful if you have experience with Java-based web development, server pages, servlets, tag libraries, MVC frameworks, because I'm going to phrase a lot of what I'm talking about in terms of what you're probably used to from Java. Second, familiarity with common web programming concepts. I'm not really going to talk at all about HTML, cascading style sheets, JavaScript, etc. I'm just going to assume that you know what I'm talking about when I'm doing something that's just basic web design. So in today's agenda, we're going to cover basic content, dragging and dropping controls on the page, building forms, and that sort of thing. We'll look at actually building server controls. We'll get into the configuration of an ASP.NET application, which is one of the areas that's actually similar in concept but very different in execution than you're going to be used to from a Java environment. And then we'll take a look at one of the most important features that's built into the .NET framework that really doesn't have a direct equivalent in Java, which is caching. Finally, we'll end with a question and answer session where I will try to answer your questions either on phone or in text messages, and if there are any that I can't get to, I will try to catch up with you on email after the session is over. So I probably won't be answering your questions during the presentation, but I'll catch them at the end. So in the first piece, let's talk about web forms. What is a web form? What are the pieces that you should be familiar with from the Java development? What's going to be different? So web form is roughly equivalent to a JSP page. So a lot of what you're going to see on the slide is going to be similar to what you would expect from a JSP page. JSP gets compiled into a servlet behind the scenes, and then the servlet is actually what gets executed. ASP.NET, the ASP page gets compiled into system.web.ui.page class, and that's actually what gets executed. The big difference between the two is that in JSP, you've just got one page and you're dealing with that one page. In ASP.NET, you're dealing with the front-end page, which has your HTML and your tags and all of the things you'd be used to thinking of from JSP. And then you've got a separate page called a code behind file. The big change from ASP.NET 1.0 and 1.1 to ASP.NET 2.0 is how that code behind file is actually integrated with the front-end page. In .NET 2.0, there's a new concept called a partial class. And we talked about this briefly in the first session, but to reiterate, a partial class is not like any other object-oriented concept you're used to. You're used to thinking in terms of interfaces and abstract classes and concrete classes. Partial class is really exactly what it says. It's half of the class. So the code behind file is half of the class. The ASP.NET page is the other half of the class. When the code gets compiled, the two pieces actually merge together, basically combining the code that you write with the graphics that you build in the ASP.NET page, and then there's some internal plumbing that the compiler puts together to link up the controls that match between the two. So the two different files that you have actually become one class in the end. There's a lot of advantages to this. Most of them end up being fairly technical, but the biggest one is that you remove some of the inheritance problems that ASP.NET 1 and 1.0 earlier had that could occasionally cause some things to break for strange reasons. It's kind of a complicated inheritance formula, and now with the partial classes, it's really doing what you want it to do. You really have two separate views into a web form, the graphics and the code, and they are the same class, so there's no merge problems. They get merged automatically by the compiler. So what about inside the forms? Well, if you're used to programming in Java, you may be used to thinking of directives, the page directive, the import directive, and tagline. All three of those have direct comparisons in ASP.NET. You still have a page directive, you still have an import directive, and the taglib changes a little bit because ASP.NET uses controls instead of tag libraries, but the register directive does almost the same thing as a tag library. So in the code below it at the bottom of the slide, you can see that you've got a page directive that an ASP.NET is going to define a language. Remember, you can build ASP.NET in any of the .NET languages, C#, ASP, or C#, Visual Basic, J#, and a few others. Has the links to the code behind file so that we can match up the front end page with the actual code page. Has an attribute called auto event wire up, which we'll get into a little bit later on. And talks about an inheritance function. So if you wanted to do inheritance on the page, you could actually do that as well. So there's a lot of attributes on page, just like you would find in JSP. The register function is the same thing again that you would see with a tag library. With a tag library directive, you have to identify the tag library you're using, you have to give it a prefix, and tell it where the code is coming from. In this case, you're doing a register directive, you're giving it a prefix, you're giving it a name, and then you're giving it a location for where the source is coming from. In this case, it's a user control file. So very, very similar to what you're used to in JSP. If you think of using a directive, you have something very similar in the .NET side. These extra directives are ones that you generally won't use as much. The implements is if you actually have a page that implements an interface for some reason, which is really rare. Control is used when you're actually defining a control file, and we're going to take a look at one of those later. Assembly and reference and output cache are things, especially for tuning how the application gets built and deployed. So other things that you're used to seeing inside of a JSP page that have pretty much direct equivalents are intrinsic objects and actions. And the JSP, you're used to using application to stash things in an application directory or application memory. You have the same thing for ASP.NET. Session, you have the same thing. The difference is the syntax of how you add and store attributes, and we'll take a look at that later. The request response, pretty much the same thing. The biggest difference between JSP and ASP.NET in the request is that request in ASP.Net is read-only. So you cannot modify a request and forward it on to another page. You end up actually creating a new copy if you even need to do it, which generally you don't, just because of some architecture difference. So again, there's some differences in the way they're implemented, but in concept, there's a lot of similarities. And then the forward and include actions from a JSP get handled by the server tag inside of ASP.NET. So if you need to do a transfer, instead of trying to do a forward, you do server transfer. If you need to do include, you do server.include. But otherwise, again, very similar in concept to what you're used to from JSP. If you're on this morning session, the last two slides really fall into that first category of similar approaches to solving similar problems. A lot of what you know is going to be the same in C# as it is in Java. Very similar syntax, very similar keywords, slight changes in how it's actually implemented, and slight changes maybe in capitalization. So next we look at server controls. Server controls in ASP.NET are probably closest to Java tag libraries. Concept behind them is that you take the built-in widgets from ASP.NET and you put them together in a way that you happen to like, store that as a control that you can reuse on multiple pages. Very, very simple to do. The nice part about it is that all of the built-in server controls are automatically rendered into HTML that's browser-specific, and we're going to look at this in the demo here in just a minute. So events. This is one area where ASP.NET development becomes a little bit different than Java development. In Java, pretty much any time that you perform any action, it's either going to be pure client-side, if you're using JavaScript, or it's going to go back to the server. And when it goes back to the server, you generally are going to post to a new page or do some magic to do a repost. In ASP.NET, there's a concept called a postback, which means that by default, any action on a form, like hitting a login button or hitting a submit button, posts back to the same page with additional information, and then you process that postback as an event. So if I hit the login button, what's actually happening is that I'm doing a post to the server saying, go to my login page, I just did a post, here's the information that was in the form. That event gets processed by something called an event handler, which in this case would be button1_click. I find out who sent me the event and any arguments associated with it, and then I can make changes to the page or I can do any code action that I'm required to do. One of the things that's hidden code inside of ASP.NET, and we can take a look at it later, is how that is actually linked up. The events and the event handler structure in ASP.NET is really nice. It's actually probably closest to what you may be used to if you've ever played with Java Swing applications, and that you can hook up multiple event handlers to any event source. So in this code down on the bottom, you're seeing that the button one object has a click event, and we're doing an addition of a event handler that's the button one click method. So basically, we're giving a reference to the method that we want to execute whenever that event fires. Pretty nice subscription system, very, very flexible. It's automatically wired for you, so if you just want to use default events with one method and one event, you're all set, and the development environment can take care of the hookup. If you want to do something more complex, if you wanted to, for instance, have a separate logging function that also needed to get called every time the click event happened, you could just add an extra event handler down here at the bottom, and that would certainly be one approach to grabbing the log. So let's take a look at actually building an application. So give me a second, and here we are in VisualStudio.net. Now, if you're on the first session, I didn't show you the startup page, and I talked briefly about it. With Visual Studio 2005, the default startup page has headlines, has some getting started links that will help you out, and also has a streaming link, basically a channel that shows you all of the latest MSDN articles about C#, and that's just because I happen to choose Visual C# projects as my default. If you chose to set up your starting differently, you can either make this page not appear at all or choose different channels to subscribe to. So let's actually take a look at building a form. So I've got my application, which is the same one that we were looking at in the first session, and I'll run it here in just a second. But I want to actually create a new page. So I'm going to go into my application, and I'm going to say add new item. I'm going to add a new web form. I'm actually going to associate it with my master page, which we talked about before, and I'll show you in just a second. And I want my code in a separate file, so I'm going to create a code behind file. Instead of calling it default 2, I'm just going to call it calendar. So I add my page, and the first thing that happens is that I get a pop-up asking me to select the master page template. Now, in the first session, we talked about master pages as being a great way to build portals because you have true visual inheritance. So if I select masterpage.master, and then I go to my design here, I can see that my page already has my header, it already has my navigation links, it already has my login buttons, it already has my book search and my search functions, and all I have is an active content pane. It's because my master page defined all of this and defined this one area as the content pane. So when I'm building my calendar page, all I can do is mess around inside my content pane. I can't change anything else. If I wanted to change all this other stuff, I would go back up to my master. Or I could actually programmatically change some of it. So now I've got a new page. I'm going to go to my toolbox here, and I want to add a calendar. And I'm going to go through my list and find my calendar control and drag it onto the screen. Find my toolbox again. So now I've got a page that's a calendar, and it's not tied to anything and there's no functions, but I can certainly do that. I can create an event. So here's my calendar one selection change. Now I could do some code here. So I could say pop up a message box or something. Now you don't see the event handler being added because that's actually happening behind the scenes when we compile the code behind class with the ASP page. Let's take a look at some of the other things that we talked about. We go to the top of the page. The first thing we've got is our page directive. We've got the language. We've got the master file that it's associated with. We're doing our auto event wire up, which means that provided that I keep with the naming scheme that Visual Studio gives me, I don't have to worry about those event handler and event link ups. I have a link to my code file, inherit that, and title tags. If I wanted to change the title of it from untitled page to calendar, I could certainly do that here. I see that inside the content pane, which is the part that I'm left with for my master page, it has an ID, it has a placeholder, it has some other attributes associated with it, and here's my calendar. So this is just like having a JSP page with a tag library, and hopefully my JSP page, maybe I'm using something like tiles or something where I can do a similar sort of structure, but it's a lot more complicated in a Java development than it is just to inherit from the master page and drop things in. So here I have my page. Looked at the attributes, and actually I'm going to come back here one second, and I'm going to do a few other things. So I'm going to say, I don't know, maybe I want to write something to the session. And just like in JSP, I need to surround it as a code snippet. And here's my IntelliSense in action, which is another nice feature of Visual Studio. is that I have all these choices of what I can do with my session. So I can add items, I can remove items, I can set the timeout. All that good stuff is available to me, and it's through an implicit object, just exactly what you might be used to from JSP or ASP.NET. But instead, I'm going to leave that out, and I'm actually going to start up the application. And I'm going to do this a little bit differently, so show you what happens when these controls are rendered. Here's my default page, but I want to go to calendar. Oops. You know what I forgot to do was actually save calendar.aspx. And just like you'd expect from a Java application, if you don't save your code, it's actually not going to show you what you'd expect to see. So let's try that again. And there's my calendar. So I talked a whole lot about the fact that these controls are browser dependent and have different HTML that comes out and JavaScript and DHTML and all the other things that it needs depending on the browser. So here it is in Internet Explorer. Here's the same page in Firefox. There's a few differences. The link structure is a little bit different in some of these things. Some of the behaviors are potentially a little bit different, but they're modifiable. If I go to my calendar page, it's the exact same page, but now we're comparing apples to apples. You see there's really not much difference in the way the controls were rendered. There's an extra box or extra bar around the library. The fonts are just a tiny bit different, and the spacing is just a tiny bit different. If I actually did view source on this, I'm actually not going to do view source on it, but if I did view source on it and you actually found the control, you could see that there would be minor differences in how the HTML is actually rendered. All that happened automatically, and it's because ASP.NET knows about the different browser types, knows what their capabilities are, and tries to render the controls appropriately. The good news is most of the most common browser types are already built in for ASP.NET, but you can certainly modify them if you find that something doesn't work the way that you expect it to or you'd like to see it different. You can also build your own rendering engines for any new browsers or browser types you need to get into. We're actually going to take a look at that a little bit more in the next demo. So let's go back to the slides. And look a little more about custom controls. So what I was just talking about was actually something known as adaptive rendering. Then we're also going to talk about creating custom controls and using controls. So what does adaptive rendering do? Well, basically the adaptive rendering engine is one of the layers of the request pipeline inside of ASP.NET. One of the things that happens is that you go through an adapter, which says that as a control gets fired, there's a mirror set of functions for the adapter that says, okay, I know what kind of browser I am, so I'm going to use the adapter browser for IE. If I hit an onInit function and that does anything at all as far as creating a display, I'm going to fire my adapters onInit, which is going to do a translation or a mapping of HTML tags to new HTML or new whatever tag, honestly. It could be WML, it could be lots of other things. So controls can be linked to an adapter to modify the behavior in the markup. So by default, they're already marked to browser-specific adapters for most of the common browsers, including for some of the mobile devices. You can create your own adapters, and you can also override a lot of this technology. And we'll look a little bit more into that in session 3, which is tomorrow, getting into the actual architecture of ASP.NET. So creating custom controls. What if there's something that you want to do that's not available in that list of controls that you saw from the toolbox? Well, in Java, you basically are limited in what you can do. You can create a new server face, tile, maybe a tag library, a few other things, but you know nothing that's really going to solve the problem quite the way you want to. In ASP.NET, what you do is you actually create a new custom control. Now, Visual Studio 2005 gives you a good starter template, gives you the base code, and very quickly sets up the attributes for the control. Some of the nice things about the C# as a language, in fact, all of the .NET languages, is that there's built-in declarative attributes on the top. So if you've gotten into aspect-oriented programming, a lot of that is already baked into the .NET framework through the concept of attributes. And we can maybe take a look at this a little bit more tomorrow as well. But the idea of the attributes is that on a control is it's going to tell me not only what my control does during runtime, but it'll also tell me how it's going to behave during design time. So, for example, I can set up custom attributes on the control, say it's a data control, instead of custom attributes, it says that during design time, I'm going to show fake text as a placeholder. But during runtime, I'm actually going to connect to my database and grab the real data and pull it back. So once you've set up the attributes of how you want the control to behave at both design time and runtime, you add the properties of the control, which is what you saw in the demo. What do you want users to be able to configure? What values do you want them to be able to set? What selections do they want, and so on? And then you also work on rendering the control, which means that you build out how it's going to actually display. This would be one of the areas where you don't, unfortunately, have the luxury of the drag-and-drop system. So when you're building out the display for the control, the assumption is that you are going to write the code that's actually going to put out the HTML. So there's some great tutorials and demos on this on the ASP.NET site. So if you're interested in building your own controls and you find that the default set of controls from ASP.NET doesn't have what you need, there's certainly the flexibility to build your own, and there's some great things you can do with it. So once you've got your custom control built, you compile it into an assembly. And an assembly, probably the closest thing you can think of is like a jar file. There's some major, major differences between the two, but that's the closest parallel. And then in your application, you just add a reference to the assembly, and away you go. And this would be one of those areas of the major differences. Java does started off conceptually with a great thing with the jar file, but what they unfortunately didn't do was build in a signing mechanism or a versioning mechanism. Now, and there have been some add-ons and some workarounds on it over the years, but fundamentally it's still a major issue inside both the Java community and with Java developers is I don't know exactly where my class path is going. I don't know exactly which jar file is getting loaded. I don't know exactly what I have a reference to or I want to have a reference to. And my personal experience as a Java developer is that I probably spend more time troubleshooting class path issues than almost anything else. .NET took a different approach in that the assemblies are built in with a secure signature, and part of the signature is a version number. So when you add a reference to the control or to the assembly, you know exactly which version you're going to get, and your code will not compile unless that version is available, either locally or in something called a global assembly cache. And again, we're not really going to get too far into that because that's more about the fundamentals of the .NET framework than it is really ASP.NET. But again, one of the areas where there's some major differences between Java and .NET is how things get packaged and deployed. A little beyond the scope of what we're going to talk about here. Okay, so you can build custom controls, which means that you can take over and do things differently than ASP.NET natively does them. But what about configuration? One of the, again, potentially joy of Java development and certainly potentially massive headache of Java development is all the configuration files. When you package your jar, you might have a configuration file. When you package your WebAssembly, you might have a configuration file. When you deploy it to your J2E server, you probably have a different configuration file. Plus, you might have vendor-specific configuration files. It's sometimes hard to manage. ASP.NET, honestly, has somewhat similar but also a very different approach to that. There's a lot of parameters that you can control inside of an ASP.NET application, and you can control them at a lot of different levels. The good news is that with ASP.NET 2.0, Microsoft has really, really worked on improving the management tools. And we'll see that here in just a second in the demo. But first, what can you configure? Well, on each server, the fundamental configuration is something called the machine.config file. That sets server-level configuration and sets the defaults for all applications. It also has some very specific functions for controlling the ASP.NET process. There's literally hundreds of configuration options available, but some of the fun things you can do with a machine config file is set your ASP.NET process to automatically reset itself after it's either been awake and alive for a certain amount of time, whether it's used a certain amount of memory, whether it's had a certain number of requests. All of these things you can configure machine config to basically dump the runtime and reload it, and it won't actually generally affect your users. There's some caveats to that that we'll get into tomorrow a little bit as well. So the machine config is your top-level configuration. And then you have what's known as a web config, which there's a top-level one for each application. And the web config basically overrides some of the parameters that you see in machine config. So this tells you what your specific application is going to do. If your specific application needs different connection information, different features, or if you just want a place to put configuration for your particular application, you could throw it in the web config file. One of the new things for ASP.NET 2.0 is that you can actually create web config files at lower levels inside your application. So you could potentially have one for each folder that would be locally overridable attributes. But again, very specific to the application and controls a little bit different things than machine config, although there's some overlap. So let's take a look at the configuration here because there's a lot to see. So I'm going to shut down my calendar page here. And the first thing I want to show you is where the files actually fit on the server. As you noticed, I've got my Windows folder open to Microsoft.net, and there's always a framework folder. And then inside the framework folder, you'll have multiple folders for each version of the .NET framework that you happen to have deployed. One of the things that makes .NET very, very different than Java is that multiple versions of the framework can actually live and run quite happily side by side. So in this case, I've got version 1.0, version 1.1, and a build of version 2.0 all on my server at the same time. So I'm going to expand out my 2.0, go to the configuration file, and the first thing to take a look at is let's look at this browsers folder. This folder actually contains the various types of browsers that are built in, identified by ASP.NET. Each of these files, open one up, defines what are called capabilities, which are links to things that ASP.NET knows about and the various built-in attributes know about whether they should draw something a certain way. So, for example, the default character height for the default browser is going to be 12, size 12 font. So a lot of good things in here, and this is one of the ways that you build your own adapters for your own browsers, is that you take advantage of these capabilities, set the values, whether they're known or unknown or false, set the IDs, set a few other things about the browser, and that will automatically tie into the adapters. The next way that you can take care of things is to actually make your own adapters for your own types of browsers. One of the questions we had earlier today in the first session was about mobile devices and whether they handle master pages and whatnot, but you can see that there's a number of mobile devices already listed in here as built-in adapters. So the values for Palm are going to be very different than the values that you'd see for IE. One is a desktop browser, one is a handheld browser, and they're going to support different features and different functions. So that's one of the configuration pieces that's hidden here. Second one I wanted to look at is this machine config file, and just because I can, I'm going to dump it into Visual Studio, which is going to color code everything for me. I can see all the various configuration sections, and this is basically just a really, really big configuration file. It has lots and lots of information in it. Generally, you won't want to change much in this file unless you're working purely locally or you know really what you're doing. Some of the things that you may want to change here eventually, if you're working like in a clustered environment, there's some settings here that configure how session identification is stored and whether you're using the same key or different key for each server. There's some things along those lines, as well as a lot of other defaults that are hidden here in the machine config file. Generally, not something you really want to change too much. One of the things I talked about was the process model. Right now, it's at the auto config, which means it's going to do whatever it thinks best. But I could come in here and change that, and add the other information to reset it after a certain number of requests or whatnot. I don't actually want to change it because it's going to mess up some of my demos later on. So I'm going to close the machine config, come back to the window, and see here's a second, which is my default web config. And this default web config is again, the default for all the applications, and it's just the starting point. So let's look at my actual application instead of the default information. So if I go to my actual application, I can see that as soon as I create the application inside of ASP.NET, I'm going to have a default web config. Now, my application's web config has a few things in it. It has connection strings, which is how I'm going to get to the database, so I don't have to hard code usernames and passwords and servers and whatnot. I can put it here. Now, if you're worried about security, I can also take it out of here and do various other things with it. There's some options for encrypting it. There's some options for lots of other choices. Since this was a simple demo, I just kind of left it in plain text instead of the web config. I can set tracing. I can set profile, which is part of the personalization features, which we briefly saw earlier today, and we'll take a look at again here in just a little bit. I can set the compilation mode of how I want it to deploy, whether I want debug to be on or off. You can set authorization and authentication of who's allowed to access this and who isn't. You may have noticed when I fired up Firefox that I had to type in a username and a password, but I didn't through Internet Explorer. One of the differences is that Internet Explorer is actually taking advantage of the single sign-on. So Internet Explorer can actually go to my computer, find out who I am, pull my identity from there, whereas Firefox doesn't. So for Firefox, I had to log on to hit the local host. You can set caching parameters, which again we're going to look at later. So there's a lot of things that you can actually set up here inside of the web config file. So if you're an ASP.NET 1 or 1.0 developer, that was kind of the end of the story, is that you had to go through and figure out what all these parameters were and how to tweak them, and you didn't even have advantage of IntelliSense, so you couldn't come in here, for example, and find out what your choices for for the local only parameter where, just because the way I'm typing it, it's not going to show up, but you had to basically go to the MSDN site and figure it out. The good news for ASP.NET 2.0 and Visual Studio 2005 is that there's now a built-in admin site that when you, I don't want to do that. Last time I tried this, I didn't have live meeting running, and if it tries to overwrite the live meeting, I may get kicked out. Hopefully, you're all still seeing me. You have an administration tool, which allows you to change all of these settings to the administration tool. So if I wanted to, for instance, configure, let's look at my application configuration. I could create application settings, which would be local properties that I could read from. I could configure an email set up on the thing. I could take the application online. I could go to my debugging and tracing. I could turn on debugging. I could turn it off. I could turn on tracing. All of this stuff is just going to basically create, change, or modify entries inside of my web config. Same thing on my provider. I could change my site management. I could change my web application stuff. A lot of things I can do from here that you used to have to always do through manual intervention inside of the web config files. So a lot of good stuff, a lot of new features with ASP.NET 2.0 and Visual Studio. This would be one of the ones that I'm very, very happy to see because it really makes it a lot easier to configure things. One of the other things that I can configure that I mentioned was that I've got a personalization set up on my website. If you're on the session this morning, you saw that we had web parts set up. So let me show you that here in case you're new. I'm going to log into the page. And I'm going to log in as user demo and give it my password. Nope, I'm going to type the password correctly. And a couple of things that are going on here. One is that user information is not being stored by me and my database schema. It's actually being stored by an ASP.NET database schema for personalization. Some of the other things that will happen is that I've got web parts here, which we talked briefly about this morning. So I can decide that I don't want to see my current user status. I'm going to minimize that. If I close this page now and then open the browser and come back again, I would see that this particular web part was already closed for me. Whereas if I log in as a different user, it's still going to look like the default value. So all that information, what is the state of my web parts, what is the state of my application, ultimately gets stored as part of that profile session. So now if I go back to my web administration, I can look at those users. I'm going to click my Manage Users button, and I see that I've got three users for my particular application. Here's the demo user. He's marked as active. I can edit his parameters, so if I needed to manually come in here and change the email address or change the description or deactivate the user, assign roles to it, lots of other things, I can do that from the administration tool. I could also then, if I really wanted to, build my own administration tool on top of the database schema. That's certainly fine, but it's nice to have it built in here. Similarly, I could deactivate the user, in which case they would still exist for audit purposes, but they wouldn't be able to log in anymore. I could also create user roles and assignments and change permissions based on all of that. My demo doesn't have any of that, but that's really what this is all about, is creating very highly configurable user security with a minimum of additional coding. So once I've set up ASP.NET to use a web server for personalization and profile information, it's automatically there. And I can administer it through a website. I can use it in my application. For example, I have my profile tag here inside of my web config file. I have a property on it for maiden name. So, for instance, if I wanted on my login page or something to gather the maiden name, I could automatically do that. It would get loaded into the profile. It would get saved into the database. And here, right there it is in my IntelliSense. So I could work with it. Basically treating it like it were a session parameter or something, even though it's not actually tied to the session. It's tied to the user and inside that database. So a lot of very, very cool things that you can do with configuration that really mean that you're spending more time configuring the application and less time coding the plumbing that fortunately is already there. So let's go back to the slides a little bit more. Okay, so some of the other things that you're going to find yourself configuring and really liking about ASP.NET is some of the built-in services. There's really built-in services for tracing, for caching, for debugging, for a lot of other things. And we'll look at most of those tomorrow in the architecture session because it really is illustrative of showing how those work by looking at what's going on deeper behind the scene. But caching is a fun one. because there really isn't a very good equivalent inside of Java. In Java, if you want to cache a JSP page, you have a couple of choices. One is that you can hope that your J2EE server has a built-in caching mechanism. Some do, some don't. Second is that you can use one of the various third-party products that handle caching, and there's a number of them. Some of the things like Hibernate have some features for caching web pages. And they do it in various different ways. They can cache the whole page. Some of them might be able to do partial caching, but it's kind of hit or miss, and you really have to go look for caching. In ASP.NET 2.0, it's built into the server. In fact, it was built in 1.0 as well, but it's a little bit different. So the first choice you have is page-level caching. And what happens is that you issue a request, or your user at a browser issues a request. First thing you do is you check the cache. And if the page is in the cache and it hasn't been expired, you get the cached page back, saving a lot of time on processing and on rendering. It can be much, much, much faster. Second thing you do is if you hit the cache and you find out that the page isn't in the cache or that it's expired, then you go back to the application, you regenerate the page, and issue the new page back to the user. The fun thing about ASP.NET is that all of this is configured at a page level. In fact, you can actually configure it at an application level, but at a page level, it's configured through the equivalent of a directive, the output cache directive. A couple of different parameters in here. The first one is duration, how many seconds do you want it to live? Second is a variety of things depending on how you want to cache it. You can cache by location, so what kind of browser is it that called me, or where are they calling from, and I can cache it that way. You can cache by header, so if you've got a page that like is a catalog of parts and the query string parameters provide you information about what actually is going to appear on the page, you could actually cache based on that header, what's coming in on that, sorry, you can actually cache based by the parameters, which is the third option. You identify the parameter name, give it a time limit, and then you'll cache the page by parameter. You can cache by header, so this allows you to do some browser-specific caching, for example. So you could cache different pages in different languages as you get the language, the user's language from the browser. So if you've got an international site that is going to give pages back in English, German, French, and Japanese, you could vary by the header because the header is going to tell you which language it wants back, and that's another way to do caching. So this is all page-level caching, and you can set it up on a per-page basis, and you can actually set it up on an application basis if you want to. The next layer down is what's known as partial caching, which means that you don't necessarily want the whole page to be cached because some of it may be dynamic, but you want most or part of the page to cache. So again, you can set up the output cache with the duration, and then you can do what's called a vary by control, which means that certain pages may or may not, or sorry, certain parts of the page may be automatically generated based on which control or which property comes in. So what happens then is you get the request, it goes to the cache, the request and the cached components all go to the application, and then the application only renders, only processes the parts that aren't cached and sends the combined information back. So it's faster than sending the whole request straight to the application and getting it back, but it's potentially a little slower than having the whole page cached. Now, why would you want to do this? Well, quite often you'll have websites where certain things are fixed all the time, like, you know, or fixed long enough to be worth caching, like our product catalog is an example. What may change regularly would be the ad that you want to display on the screen. So you don't want to do a page-level caching because the ad control may or may not be rotating, or you may not want to fix that in place. You may always want to get a new ad because there's some processing on and you want to keep track of clicks and whatnot. So you do a partial caching of everything that's supposed to be static or semi-static, and then you wouldn't bother caching the pieces that are supposed to change. The third level of caching that you can get into is actually caching program data. And there's a lot of fun things you can do with this. First off is that you have an implicit object called a cache object, which is really just a name value collection. Syntax for name values for collections in C# is obviously a little different than Java, and that you issue the name inside of brackets and quotes. But you can do add to the cache, you can do remove from the cache. You can also do expirations inside the cache. So you can insert a new key with a value, some other parameters that include how long it should live in the cache, and you know some other options along it. So let it live there forever, let it live there for until it hasn't been requested for 30 seconds. A lot of different options that can go in there. Finally, you've got dependencies, which are, again, a new kind of caching thing, which means that the value that's stored in the cache is dependent on some other piece of the application or some other piece of data. So, for example, if you had a XML file that had, say, the values for drop-down lists, and you wanted to cache that until the XML file changed. JSP, you'd have to probably write some fairly complicated mechanism to figure out how to monitor that XML file change and know when it changed to dump your cache. ASP.NET, all you do is you insert a cache dependency on a data file, and then basically the server is automatically going to monitor that data file, and as soon as it changes, it's going to dump the cache, which means that the next request is going to get the new information. Nice thing to have. It basically triggers for cache data. The other thing you can do is create dependencies on SQL Server, and this mechanism is actually open, so you can create your own new dependency types if you want to. So the next one is SQL cache invalidation. If you happen to be using SQL Server as your data source, you can update your cache based on triggered off of database changes. So you've got your web application, which is read mostly for users that say they're looking at information. Then you have some other processing engine in the back that's updating the database on a transactional system. If the data that the web application has is going to, you want to load it into a cache to improve performance. But if that transactional system comes in behind the scenes and changes the data, you want to dump your cache. You need to know that you need to dump it. So that's where SQL cache invalidation comes in, is that you basically get a notification from the database as soon as the data has changed. Now that triggers your application to dump the cache. And it uses something for data connection. So it's built in for Microsoft SQL Server, but it's an interface that you can then implement and build for your own database if you want to. I'm pretty sure that I've seen one vendor who's got one out for Oracle, and there may be a few others now that are out there. So again, really, really nice feature for web applications, which again are going to be generally read mostly on databases. If you don't want to go through a merged data layer, if you just want to be able to read and dump the cache when you need to, that's what SQL cache invalidation is really good for. So let's take a look at one of those and what's going on inside caching. So this application is already set up to do caching, and I'm going to close a few pages here just to get them out of the way, and open the search results page here. So my search results page means that when I've searched for a book, it's going to return a list in a data-bound grid. And the nice thing about it is that it's, it should be fairly fast kind of search because it's, it's going against a SQL Server. It's just doing a simple query, the kind of stuff that databases are really, really good at. But at the same time, I don't really expect a whole lot of user demand on my library site. So I don't want that information to, I don't expect that information to change all that often. So I'd rather cache the page than relook at it. So if somebody enters in the same request over and over again, I don't want to have to waste the resources to rerun the query each time. But I do want my cache to be tied to the data table so that if somebody checks out a book, I want to make sure I'm listed as not being available. So if I take a look at my data list, if I look at my control, I've got a hidden one that's my SQL data source. That's my connection between my data grid here and my database. If I look at the properties from that, and I'm actually going to again pull this out up here so it's a little more visible. I can see that first thing is that I've got a SQL cache dependency on the library database on the books table. So my cache dependency means that if any changes occur to the books table, I'm going to get notified and I'm going to dump my cache. Got some other cache properties here. I'm going to store my cache forever because unless there's a change to the database, I don't need to dump the cache, but I could also change it to various time values. I could create a different expiration policy, which says that do I want to cache it for 10 minutes always, or do I want to cache it for 10 minutes between requests? So if I haven't had a request within 10 minutes, I'm going to drop it, or do I want it to just be from the time I load the data until 10 minutes has passed? Is that the length of the cache? So that's the difference between absolute and sliding. Key dependency, I don't have one for this because that would be on an internal data source. And there's some other properties that I can configure that way. But basically, my caching is then completely set up merely by setting some properties on my data source. I don't have to do anything else. Now those properties are actually being translated back into here, into my SQL data source. You can see that there's the connection string. Enable caching is set to true. Provider name, SQL cache dependency, where's the table? So that's, if I were typing this by hand, I would type it in that way, but fortunately I've got Visual Studio and I can just edit the properties. The other piece that's missing from this is in actually the web config file. So if I go to my web config file, I can see that I've got my SQL cache dependency piece, which is down here at the bottom, got a whole set of properties that I can configure just for caching. I can see that I've got SQL cache dependency enabled to true. I can find my database that I'm going against the library, that my connection string is lib connection string, which is what I had to find up at the top. And then I've got a poll time, and the poll time's in milliseconds. So basically, every second and a half, I'm going to poll the database and find out whether something's changed or not. And the database is going to basically tell me yes or no. If it tells me yes, something's changed, I dump my cache and move on. So that's basically how caching works for the SQL cache dependency. For some of the other caching, there's some fun demonstrations that I've seen of how caching works in the very vary-by controls and vary-by parameters. I'm going to leave that off for now so that we have some time for questions and answers. So I'm going to close my demo down and move on to the wrapping up. Okay, so the first thing is that you can certainly build like you would in JSP. You've got a lot of the same concepts. You've got a lot of the same features. You're adding components to a page. You've got a mix of HTML and tags. The tags look like tag library tags. Back end, they're a little bit different. Visual Designer, which is something you generally don't have in Java development unless you're using one of the higher-end IDEs and have gotten into Java Server Faces and some things like that. The good thing is you can take advantage of a lot of the built-in framework. You've got built-in framework for master pages, for web parts, for a lot of things that you have to write a lot of plumbing code for inside of Java, or, again, use a third-party library. A lot of that's built into .NET. Good to take advantage of it. Same thing is you should really take advantage of the built-in services. The caching, the profile management, the user management, all that stuff is there because Microsoft looked at it and realized that everybody was writing the same code over and over again. So they rolled it into the framework. And as we're going to see tomorrow morning in that session, even though it's built into the framework, it's built in such a way that you can extend, override, replace, turn it off, do a lot of different things with it. And we'll really get into that tomorrow. So for more information, www.asp.net is a great place to go. It's got all the quick starts. It's got a lot of starter code and examples and good articles on how to get into ASP.NET and also these various features. .NET.com is a more general site for .NET development. You'll find a lot of things there about C#. And then also the ASP.NET Developer Center, which is msdn.microsoft.com/ASP.NET. That's really the best starting place for ASP.NET development. If you're a Java developer, msdn.microsoft.com/vstudio/java has a lot of information about migrating from Java, also getting started in Java getting started in .NET from a Java background. Then that's a good place to go. And to preempt some of the questions, or at least one of the questions that I'm sure there's a number of you that have asked, I will try to make the sample code available. And basically, if you send me a question I'll try to get you guys to give me your email, or I'll post my email so that I can get it to you. It'll take a couple of days to wrap it up. It's not the cleanest code at all. It's just a quick and dirty demo code, but it illustrates a lot of the features. So with that, I'd like to turn it back over to Jeff and go through questions and answers.
Okay, thanks, Rob. I'd like to take a minute here to share some additional resources. As Rob mentioned, we will be looking at some questions here in a moment. But if you haven't already asked a question, you can always do that by typing your question into the field next to the Ask button in the Question Manager, and then just simply click Ask. And I will be providing a survey for today's event in just a minute. Please take a few moments to complete the survey when that comes up. Feedback and comments that you provide ultimately allow us to create better webcasts for you. Your feedback is greatly appreciated. I got a couple of URLs here I'd like to give out. Maybe you're interested in upcoming or previously live webcasts. Here's a URL for you to check out. If you have an idea for a webcast, perhaps you'd like to see specific content developed for a future webcast, there's a URL for you. And, of course, today's webcast was presented using Microsoft Office Live Meeting, and you can go here to download a free 14-day trial. And by filling out today's webcast evaluation, you are automatically entered in to win one of these 40-gigabyte Creative Zen Ultra MP3 players. 10 of these players will be awarded each month. And here is the webcast evaluation coming up. There it is. Please follow the links provided in your interface and take a few moments to complete today's webcast evaluation. Again, your comments are very valuable. And with that, looks like we got a number of questions in the queue. I will turn it back over to Rob to take a look at those. Rob?
Okay, I've been going through a few of these, and there's some some that I've been answering directly and some that I think I'm just going to talk through right now. The first one is, if you change settings in the web config file, do you have to restart IIS? The answer is no. There's actually a lot of differences there. If you're an old school Java developer, you remember the dark days when any change to pretty much any page except maybe a JSP required a server restart. Same thing with ASP developers, that pretty much any time you try to change anything, particularly if it was a DLL behind the scenes, required a full server reboot. ASP.NET has gone way past that. If you change the web config, it automatically gets picked up, and because basically there's a cache monitor on it, just natively. So it automatically gets picked up and things get changed. The caveat to that is that when you do change the web config file, it does create a whole application restart, but not an IIS restart. So there's some caveats to that, and actually we're going to get into that a little bit more tomorrow, because that really ties, the biggest trick to that ties into how session is handled. So again, hopefully if you're joining tomorrow's session, I can talk about that more, about what really happens when you change things behind the scenes. Caching absolutely works for a clustered web server. That's another area where you might need to make a tweak for the ASP.NET page, because generally, if I remember correctly, the default setting is that it's on a per-server cache, not a cross-server cache. But the dependencies, particularly the SQL cache dependency, is cross-server cache. So it, you know, if you're all using the same database, you'll all get notified at the same time, and it'll dump the cache at the same time. If you're doing a dependency on something else, like a file, and you know, then you're worried about whether that file gets copied to all the servers at the same time and how that's going to restart things. So there's, again, a little bit of caveat to it, but generally it will work for clustered server. That's an architectural decision. You really want to be careful about what you're caching on a cluster versus caching on a single server, and whether it really makes a difference if there's, you know, a half second or second delay between caches getting dumped or whatnot. Another question on when using a partial cache, if you see the same control on two separate pages, is the control cached one time and shared by both pages? Generally not, because when you've got the control on the page, you give it a unique ID, and that's actually the value that they're using as a key for the caching. So it's a page level control cache as opposed to a cross-page control cache. That gets a little weirder with potentially with web parts, but that's very much beyond the scope of what I want to try to get into in the question and answer session, and fairly deep into some of the weirder things about ASP.NET. Question on creating a model view controller application through ASP.NET. I'm glad you asked that, because that's exactly what tomorrow's session is about. So if you can be a little patient, and hopefully you're signed up for tomorrow's session, most of that session will be talking about architectural patterns like MVC. Next question right after that is there a servlet equivalent, and do all requests have to hit pages? Again, something we're really going to get into tomorrow. The short answer is that it depends on what you mean by a servlet. Servlets started out in the beginning as the only answer for development. It was actually very close to a CGI bin model, where your servlet caught the request and had to generate all the HTML internally. But then as Java has developed, it's gone very much away from that, to where servlets are effectively non-graphical request grabbers. There's something directly equivalent to that in .NET, but it's not a servlet. It doesn't have the same functionality as a servlet as far as generating pages. So we're going to get into that again very much part of tomorrow's session. Whether all requests have to hit pages, that again is another architectural consideration. There's really now three separate patterns for that. The .NET controls can run at the server. Some of them can run at the server. Some of them can run at the client side, in which case you don't hit the server when you do a request. And then there's also some new technologies coming in for AJAX support, one of which I'd love to show you tomorrow as well, which is the virtual Earth site. So the answer is it depends on exactly what you're doing, which means probably no is the best answer. Let's see. Caching right now through SQL Server caching, sorry for the SQL dependency cache right now is only built in for SQL Server. Like I said, I believe that there are some third parties building caching mechanisms for other databases, and I think I've seen one for Oracle that may be in beta. So it could be something coming to whatever database you're interested in. And like I said, it's a documented interface that you would just have to build your own SQL cache class and then make it work. And that's, you know, certainly something you can do, but it would be getting into plumbing code. Okay, got a question on how the profile object knew about the maiden name property. How did it get defined, and how IntelliSense knew about it? Let's see. For that, I kind of want to share the desktop again. Let me see if I can do that.
No, you don't want to do that, Rob.
I don't want to do that?
No, you got to leave that
okay.
Evaluation up for people to get through the links.
Okay, let me try to explain it on the phone then. The profile object is automatically generated by the ASP.NET runtime. Visual Studio is smart enough to do that on the fly. So the profile object looks at the configuration file, grabs any properties that are defined in the configuration file, and defines that as its own. In the case of the profile object, when I defined it, I just added it as a name, so I think it defaults out to string. There may be a way to define it as other data types, but I don't know off the top of my head. The answer is that what you're really seeing there was some magic that was being performed by Visual Studio 2005 with how it handles IntelliSense and how it knows basically to auto-compile things that are defined in the web config file. So the closest equivalent you may be familiar with in Java is some of the object builders and things like that will automatically read config files and turn them into objects for you to use. So does ASP.NET or Windows have any sort of scheduling mechanisms such as crontab and Unix? Again, the answer is going to depend on what you're using it for. ASP.NET, the machine config file, has some built-in scheduling, so if you wanted to reset it based on memory, time, and whatnot, you could certainly do that. Windows has a variety of scheduling mechanisms, but again, without knowing more about what you're trying to get into, it may or may not be completely off topic. Got a question on how the ASPX page and its CS file are combined during compilation. That's, again, sort of the magic of the partial class keyword. What really happens is that the compiler looks for that partial class, looks for the attribute that matches up which two pieces should go together, and compiles that into a single class behind the scenes. So you don't ever need to do anything about it. Just make sure that the code behind file and the ASPX file have the right tags. And again, if I you take a look at any ASP.NET page that has a code behind file, and you'll see in the page attribute, it actually defines what the code file is. So there's some information there that the compiler uses to link them up. I'm looking for some other questions that I can actually answer fairly easily here. Got a question, but what is the MS Portal product? The proper answer to that, I think what you're looking for is actually Microsoft SharePoint. SharePoint was the portal product. It actually pioneered the web parts, the pieces that I was showing you. The latest version of SharePoint is actually fully integrated with ASP.NET 2.0, and that if you build a web part in ASP.NET 2.0 for a standalone web application, you can import that into SharePoint, and then you have advantage of all of the SharePoint controls as well. So there's a lot of integration going on between the two. So if you're interested in a full-blown portal product, take a look at SharePoint, but a lot of what you're doing for customizing SharePoint ends up being just ASP.NET application. Got a question about recommending whether I'd use the ported frameworks like Spring.NET and Hibernate to ease a transition from Java. I'd really like to defer that one until the fourth session, which is Wednesday morning, because that's actually one of the big considerations of whether you want to keep Java architecture or you want to move pure ASP.NET architecture. And there's some pros and cons to doing both, so really I would look at it almost on a case-by-case basis of what you get by keeping the architecture versus what you get by maybe moving entirely to master pages and themes and built-in ASP.NET features. Got a question on Mono, which is the Unix port of .NET. I'm not really up at the moment on the latest efforts of Mono with ASP.NET. I know that they at least got it partially working a year and a half or 2 years ago, but I don't know where they are with ASP.NET 2.0, so unfortunately I can't really answer that question. Basically, what the goal of Mono would be is to create a fully functional ASP.NET that does everything that you saw here, but runs on Linux, Unix-type platforms. Some of the big tricks to that is that the service layer underneath it all really doesn't map all that well between Windows and Unix. There's a lot of things that are very, very different. a lot of things that just don't have direct equivalents or have equivalents that are fairly complicated to pretend that they match. So I really don't know how that development is going or how far they are, but it's a noble effort at least. I've got a question about whether the SQL Server cache can be configured at the field level or is it only at the table level. I'm pretty sure you can actually take it down to the field level. The example that I showed was at the table level because I was basically pulling everything from the table. So if any row changed at all, I wanted the whole cache to be dumped. Unfortunately, I don't think you can configure it to be row level specific. So if you know the first 100 rows stay the same, leave it. But if the last 100 rows change, I don't think it's quite that smart. But you know, as a starting point, it sure beats always hitting the database to pull the same query over and over. Okay, got a question. If you're not allowed to use a direct connection from the web server to the database, what do you use as a mid-tier? What I'd recommend, actually, if you can, is go look at the, when you get the link for this session, go look at the first session because I had a session on data access there. Basically, you can create data providers that map to almost anything. They can be tied to objects, they can be tied to collections, they can be tied direct to a database, they can be tied to XML files. So if you've got a good, solid object data layer, there's nothing preventing you from doing almost everything I did on that page, connecting to the data objects instead of trying to connect to the database. The caveat to that is I don't think you have an equivalent for the SQL data cache, but then you can use some of the other caching mechanisms as triggers instead. So you can use an object kind of cache and dump things that way. But there are a lot of options there. If you also go to, I think, www.asp.net has a whole bunch of things on various data models of how to use ASP.NET under various conditions, whether you can talk direct to the database, you have to go through a middle layer, what kind of middle layer works best and whatnot. Let's see. I think that's all of the questions that I want to get into on the phone. Some of these I think I might try to follow up privately on. Does anyone have any new questions or? Okay, then I will definitely try to grab the, get the log here and try to follow up with the people I can just on typing.
Okay, well, anything else to add, Rob, before we take it out?
I think that's it. Thanks for coming. Thanks for the questions. They're all very good. I'd love to see you tomorrow at the session on ASP.NET architecture and then on Wednesday in the session on migrating from Java to ASP.NET.
Okay, great. Well, I would like to extend a special thank you to Rob for presenting today. And thanks to everyone for attending this webcast. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes today's MSDN webcast. Thanks again for joining us. You may now disconnect from the audio portion of this conference.